This is Kurt Anderson. I'm here on the National Mall in Washington, D.C. I'm looking at the Lincoln Memorial now from straight on, and what I'm looking at is the back of the $5 bill. In fact, most of us probably have a portrait of the Lincoln Memorial in our pockets right now. And if you don't have a five, look at a penny. It's there, too. We may not think about the Lincoln Memorial very often, but it's with us, each of us, in so many ways, all the time.
In this temple, as in the hearts of the people for whom he saved the Union, the memory of Abraham Lincoln is enshrined forever.
As he sits there on his chair looking down, you're drawn in to the spirit of a very great man.
The glowy light and the marble.
And even though it's marble, the guy seems to have a life force within him.
I was here in 1945, and I got up there and touched his hands. Yeah. Just like if he was alive, you know.
And then, of course, the words chiseled on the wall like a tombstone slash prayer.
47 years ago, our fathers brought
forth... At this second appearing to take the oath of the presidential office.
Not knowing what the future would hold, I would head on over to the Lincoln Memorial and just sit on the steps at the top and just be quiet.
It moves my mind to an attempt to embrace the enormity.
I think it's the most sacred secular spot in Washington, D.C.
It just seems almost beyond imagination how a persona could be so big and the whole place seems so big.
It's so much bigger than what I can see.
I'm Kurt Anderson, and today in Studio 360, how the Lincoln Memorial came to be and became an American icon. It's a monument to a man who was maybe the most divisive and the most revered leader this nation has ever had. And it looks pretty good on a stamp or a postcard or a $5 bill.
I just finished college, and I was going to be an intern in D.C., and I took the train from Montana, and I'd never been east of the Mississippi, and, you know, I think I knew two people in that town at that point, and it's like, oh, him I know, kind of like seeing, like, a friendly, familiar face.
That is the friendly, familiar voice of Sarah Vowell, the public radio commentator and serious American history buff. She wrote a book about presidents killed in office. It's called Assassination Vacation, which is a pretty good indication of how ironic Vowell tends to be. But I wondered, was your irony defeated by this gigantic memorial?
Well, I mean, yeah, it does defeat irony momentarily. I go there every time I'm in D.C. just as a, you know, it is a, like, pilgrimage place for me. And I remember once, and I'm always roping my friends into going, and I took my friend Dave there, and he looked around, he's like, it's just so suspicious. I was like, what is he, like, all these people? And it was true. There, it's just like this very, like, almost suspiciously rainbow colored assortment of people. And, you know, once I actually saw standing there reading the Gettysburg Address, a guy in a cowboy hat reading it next to a Hasidic Jew.
That kind of unity, the recognition of a common ground, is one of the ideals the Lincoln Memorial has come to represent in the United States. But in fact, there was contentious debate over whether or not it would even be built, decades worth of contention.
We take it so for granted, it seems so inevitable, like, of course it would be there. No, there was a fight about where it would be. Of course it would look like that. No, there was a huge fight about that.
There was very little enthusiasm, I would say, for the Lincoln Memorial. In southern quarters, he was, in other words, he was a divisive figure.
Christopher Thomas is an historian, the author of a book called The Lincoln Memorial and American Life. He says that in the years following the Civil War, people tried to build a memorial to Lincoln. The first attempt, right after his death in 1865, envisioned an 80-foot-tall bronze and granite sculpture.
It was gigantic. It was towering.
And it sort of resembled a great big wedding cake.
It was a stone pedestal rising in tiers with, at various levels, a total of 36 figures of politicians, abolitionists, and others associated with the Union cause, shown in tiers rising up the pedestal with allegorical figures representing Lincoln's virtues near the top, and on the very summit, a seated figure of Lincoln shown with his pen signing the Emancipation Proclamation.
In other words, a huge, over-the-top version of the kind of old-fashioned monument that's now completely ignored in cities across America. The effort to build that one fizzled by the 1880s.
It never collected enough money. And it wasn't until his memory could be, so to speak, resuscitated for the cause of national unity that he could be commemorated on large scale in the Capitol.
In 1900, the city of Washington, D.C. still wasn't finished. The mall was just a mess of railroad tracks. Around that time, American politicians were rediscovering Pierre L'Enfant, the French immigrant and army engineer who drew up plans for Washington, D.C. originally after the Revolution. L'Enfant had a very French revolutionary view that in a democracy, patriotism should replace organized religion. And D.C. would be a kind of secular mecca to which Americans would make a pilgrimage at least once in their lives. By the early 1900s, city leaders decided that a memorial to Lincoln would be the perfect centerpiece for their new mall.
Until then, it really hadn't been possible to reach any agreement on a memorial to Lincoln in the Capitol. But the proposal is sort of flown in under the radar by treating the Lincoln Memorial as a memorial to the Union. And Lincoln is sort of flown into the scheme as the reuniter of America rather than as the emancipator of the slaves.
A uniter. That was something everybody could get behind. That's why there aren't any references to race or freed slaves in the memorial we see today. We read Lincoln's Gettysburg Address and second inaugural address in the memorial, not the Emancipation Proclamation. But that big omission isn't what got criticized at the time. It was architect Henry Bacon's design for the building.
If you really think about the architecture of it, it's ridiculous. And the Chicago chapter of the American Institute of Architects just erupted when they saw that Greco-Roman design, because it seemed so silly to them that their prairie sun be memorialized with this, you know, weird Greek temple.
In fact, no less than Frank Lloyd Wright went on record at the time, calling it
one of the most ridiculous, most asinine miscarriages of building material that ever happened.
Wright hated the idea of new buildings literally imitating ancient architecture. What did a Greek temple have to do with Abe Lincoln, the rail splitter? Wright wrote of Lincoln, "He is the Greek antithesis. Nothing is Greek about his life or work or thought." The classicist architect Alan Greenberg, a professor at Yale, has a quibble here with Frank Lloyd Wright.
Well, it's actually not at all like a Greek temple. A Greek temple has a pediment.
The pediment, that's the low-pitched triangular gable you see on the front of some classical roofs. The Lincoln Memorial has a flat roof that runs straight across.
In fact, it's much more Mayan. You have this quite steep, unbroken flight of stairs.
It's a very long staircase.
It's not Greek to architect and critic Witold Rybczynski either.
Greek temples had three steps, and that was it. The other thing which he does is that there isn't really a door into the interior. It's just the wall just opens up. You just sort of drift in, and I think that connection of inside and outside also makes it less like a sanctuary, and it's always there. It's a truly a public open place.
I'm standing at the bottom of the marble steps. I can see Lincoln inside, but it really looks huge from here, from this perspective. And according to my tourist brochure here, we are 39 feet above the Potomac and surrounded by 39 columns as well.
Each of the columns around the building are dedicated to one of the states of the Union at the time of the Civil War. It's so inscribed above the column. And the ancient Greeks believed that columns were people. So each of those columns actually is a citizen of every state holding up this building.
You can see the building quickly, but you must look at the sculpture slowly. But I'm biased, of course.
Leonda Fink is a sculptor herself, and she is a great admirer of Daniel Chester French, the artist who created this sculpture of Lincoln in there?
We have this tremendous sculpture with a great deal of power and strength.
He's huge, Lincoln, this marble Lincoln. If he could stand up, he'd be 28 feet tall. It sort of reminds me, looking at him up there, of the sculptures of the pharaohs in Egypt or of Lenin or Stalin in the old Soviet Union. Only, it's not heroic in the way that those usually are.
There is the very vulnerable human sitting there, just like we are, one of the people. And so you have the extreme of power and gentleness.
Very benign, very fatherly in a way.
Yeah, the wise, sad statesman.
I would think thoughtful. He needed to sit down and think about things.
Lincoln is sitting, which is unusual in terms of depictions of political figures. Most sculptures of political leaders are shown in some very heroic pose, standing or on horseback, sword in hand, chin up.
It is not a figure in a uniform, nor with trappings, outward trappings to say, this is great, strong America. He's very much a man of the people.
And the fact that he's sitting means you can look at the whole figure at once.
You can't see the feeling of it with one long look. And the head, of course, is further away, and you come forward and see what the hands are doing. I must admit that for a while, I didn't realize that one hand was clenched and one was open.
If you look at Lincoln's hands, they're doing separate things. The one on the left, his right, is kind of draped casually over the arm of his chair, but his left hand is clenched in a fist. There's also a myth or rumor that the sculptor intended the hands to be the sign language for A and L, Lincoln's initials.
And there's no truth to it. It's bogus.
Historian Michael Richman wrote a biography of Daniel Chester French.
If you know how the letter A in sign is given, it's with the fist upraised. To show the symbol for the letter L, the hand is extended and the thumb is upright, as are the fingers. But in the statue, the hands are draped over the edge of the chair. And I've always felt that there is, if you will, the tense, determined of the left and the relaxed and compassionate of the right. And so what French is able to do in that seated figure is something which we as a normal human being cannot do. You cannot be simultaneously both tense and relaxed.
Of course, Daniel Chester French's greatest challenge as a sculptor was that face.
Lincoln is not the most classically beautiful face. I mean, he has a very bizarre face. And, you know, he was held in such esteem, and French wants to capture this esteem, but Lincoln is such a screwy-looking guy. And it takes French years just kind of trying to figure out how to sculpt him, and especially how to represent his face and convey some kind of sense of, you know, philosophical grandeur. And he spends years just reading about him and thinking about him and looking at pictures and drawings, and he, you know, he finally figures out how he wants to sculpt this thing. And French, you know, goes down to D.C. after it's installed. And lo and behold, they put that reflecting pool in. And the reflecting pool, unfortunately for French, reflects. And it looks like they're holding a flashlight underneath Lincoln's face. And he looks really startled. And it's really, really unintentionally funny.
French spent years lobbying Congress to pay for electric fixtures along the top of the memorial to fix the lighting situation and to restore the look on Lincoln's face to the grave, brooding expression we all know. But the author Doris Kearns Goodwin thinks there's still something missing.
He came to life when he spoke, when he told stories, when he laughed. Marble cannot capture that, although what happens in that memorial, which makes it so dazzling, is the combination of that gorgeous statue and the words on the wall around it.
Off to the left of the statue, if you're facing it, is the Gettysburg Address. And over in the cove to the right of the statue is the second inaugural address. Lincoln gave that speech while the Civil War was still raging.
Both read the same Bible and pray to the same God, and each invokes his aid against the other. It may seem strange that any men should dare to ask a just God's assistance in wringing their bread from the sweat of other men's faces. But let us judge not that we be not judged.
He's saying to them, you and I, we are the same. You know, we both read the same Bible. We both pray to the same God. And that's so rare in a public life that you can really look at the other side.
It was exactly the kind of union rebuilding message that the leaders of the country wanted the Lincoln Memorial to communicate in the early 1900s. But the unresolved issues of the Civil War, just decades past, hadn't gone away. America was sitting on a ticking time bomb, and it was lying at the feet of the Lincoln Memorial.
I have a dream today.
The Civil Rights Movement shakes up America in just a minute. I'm Kurt Anderson, and you're listening to American Icons, the Lincoln Memorial. This is Studio 360 from PRI, Public Radio International. Stay with us.